I knew he wasn't dead before I was halfway back. I could hear him groaning and calling my name, begging me to help him get out. I don't know if the Jolanders or the Langhills or the Karens would have heard him if they'd been home or not. I decided it was best not to wonder. I had plenty of problems without taking that on. I had to figure out what to do with him. That was the biggest thing. But I couldn't seem to get far. Every time I tried to think of an answer, this voice inside started howling at me. "It ain't fair," that voice yelled. "This wa'n't in the deal. He's supposed to be dead, goddammit. Dead." "Help! Dolores!" His voice come drifting up. It had a flat, echoey sound, as if he was yelling inside a cave. I turned on the light and tried to look down, but I couldn't. The hole in the well cap was too far out in the middle, and all the flashlight showed me was the top of the shaft, big granite rocks with moss growing all over them. The moss looked black and poisonous in the flashlight beam. Joe seen the light. "Dolores," he calls up. "For God's sake, help me. I'm all broken." He sounded broken, too, his voice all bubbly and choked. Now he was the one who sounded like he was talking through a throat full of mud. I wouldn't answer him. I felt like if I had to talk to him, I'd go crazy for sure. Instead, I put the flashlight aside, reached out as far as I could, and managed to get hold of one of the boards he'd broken through. I pulled on it, and it snapped off as easy as a rotted tooth. "Dolores!" he yelled when he heard that. "Oh, God! Oh, God, be thanked!" I didn't answer. Just broke off another board, and another, and another. By then I could see that the day had started to brighten again, and birds were singing the way they do in the summer when the sun comes up. Yet the sky was still a lot darker than it had any business being at that hour. The stars had gone in again, but the flicker flies were still circling around. Meantime, I went on breaking off boards, working my way toward the side of the well I was kneeling on. "Dolores!" His voice come drifting up. "You can have the money. All of it. And I'll never touch Selena again. I swear before God Almighty and all the angels I won't. Please, honey, just help me get out of this hole." I got up the last board. I had to yank it out of the blackberry creepers to get it loose, and tossed it behind me. Then I shone the light down into the well. The first thing the beam struck was his upturned face, and I screamed. It was a little white circle with two big black holes in it. For a second or two, I thought he'd pushed stones into his eyes for some reason. Then he blinked, and it was just his eyes, after all, staring up at me. I thought of what they must have been seeing. Nothing but the dark shape of a woman's head behind a bright circle of light. He was on his knees, and there was blood all over his chin and neck and the front of his shirt. When he opened his mouth and screamed my name, more blood came pouring out. He'd broke most of his ribs when he fell, and they must have been sticking into his lungs on both sides like porcupine quills. I didn't know what to do. I kind of crouched there, feeling the heat come back into the day. On my neck and arms and legs I could feel it, and shining the light down on him. Then he raised his arms and kind of waved them, like he was drowning. And I couldn't stand it. I snapped off the light and drew back. I sat there on the edge of the well, all huddled up in a little ball, holding my bloody knees and shivering. "Please," he called up. "Please, and please." And finally, "Please, Dolores." Oh, it was awful. More awful than anyone could imagine. And it went on like that for a long time. It went on until I thought it would drive me mad. The eclipse ended, and the birds stopped singing their good morning songs, and the flicker flies stopped circling. Or maybe it was just that I couldn't see them anymore. And out on the reach, I could hear boats tooting at each other like they do sometimes, shaving a haircut 2 bits mostly. And still, he wouldn't quit. Sometimes he'd beg and call me Honey Bunch. He'd tell me all the things he was going to do if I let him out of there. How he was going to change. How he was going to build us a new house and buy me the Buick I'd always wanted. Then he'd curse me and tell me how he was going to tie me to the wall and stick a hot poker up my snatch and watch me wiggle on it before he finally killed me. Once he asked if I'd throw down that bottle of scotch. Can you believe that? He wanted his goddamn bottle, and he cursed me and called me a dirty old used-up cunt when he seen I wasn't going to give it to him. At last it began to get dark again, really dark. So it must have been at least 8:30, maybe even 9 o'clock. I'd started listening for cars along East Lane again, but so far there was nothing. That was good, but I knew I couldn't expect my luck to hold forever. I snapped my head up off my chest sometime later and realized I'd dozed off. It couldn't have been for long, because there was still a little afterglow in the sky. But the fireflies were back, doing business as usual, and the owl had started its hooting again. It sounded a little more comfortable about it the second time around. I shifted my spot a little and had to grit my teeth at the pins and needles that started poking as soon as I moved. I'd been kneeling so long I was asleep from the knees down. I couldn't hear nothing from the well, though, and I started to hope that he was finally dead, that he'd slipped away while I'd been dozing. Then I heard little shuffling noises and groans and the sound of him crying. That was the worst, hearing him cry because moving around gave him so much pain. I braced myself on my left hand and shone the light down into the well again. It was hard as hell to make myself do that, especially now that it was almost completely dark. He'd managed to get to his feet somehow, and I could see the flashlight beam reflecting back at me from 3 or 4 wet spots around the work boots he was wearing. It made me think of the way I'd seen the eclipse in those busted pieces of tinted glass after he got tired of choking me and I fell on the porch. Looking down there, I finally understood what had happened, how he'd managed to fall 30 or 35 feet and only get bunged up bad instead of being killed outright. The well wasn't completely dry anymore, you see. It hadn't filled up again. If it had done that, I guess he would have drowned like a rat in a rain barrel. But the bottom was all wet and swampy. It had cushioned his fall a little, and it probably didn't hurt that he was drunk, either. He stood with his head down, swaying from side to side, with his hands pressed against the rock walls so he wouldn't fall over again. Then he looked up and saw me, and grinned. That grin struck a chill all the way through me, Andy, because it was the grin of a dead man. A dead man with blood all over his face and shirt. A dead man with what looked like stones pushed into his eyes. Then he started to climb the wall. I was looking right at it, and still I couldn't believe it. He jammed his fingers in between 2 of the big rocks sticking out of the side and yanked himself up until he could get one of his feet wedged in between 2 more. He rested there a minute, and then I seen one of his hands go groping up over his head again. It looked like a fat white bug. He found another rock to hold on to, set his grip, and brought his other hand up to join it. Then he pulled himself up again. When he stopped to rest the next time, he turned his bloody face up into the beam of my light, and I saw little bits of moss from the rock he was holding on to crumble down onto his cheeks and shoulders. He was still grinning. Can I have another drink, Andy? No, not the beam. No more of that tonight. Just water'll do me fine from here on out. Thanks. Thanks very much. Anyway, he was feeling around for his next hold when his feet slipped and he fell. There was a muddy squelching sound when he landed on his ass. He screamed and grabbed at his chest like they do on TV when they're supposed to be having heart attacks, and then his head fell forward on his chest. I couldn't stand any more. I stumbled my way out of the blackberry creepers and ran back to the house. I went into the bathroom and puked my guts. Then I went into the bedroom and lay down. I was shaking all over. And I kept thinking, what if he still ain't dead? What if he stays alive all night? What if he stays alive for days, drinking the seep coming out from between the rocks or up through the mud? What if he keeps screaming for help until one of the Karens or Langles or Jolanders hears him and calls Garrett Thibodeau? Or what if someone comes to the house tomorrow? One of his drinking buddies? Or someone wanting him to crew on their boat or fix an engine? And hears screams coming out of the blackberry patch. What then, Dolores? There was another voice that answered all those questions. I suppose it belonged to the inside eye, but to me it sounded a lot more like Vera Donovan than it did Dolores Claiborne. It sounded bright and dry and kiss my back cheeks if you don't like it. Of course he's dead, that voice said. And even if he isn't, he soon will be. He'll die of shock and exposure and punctured lungs. There are probably people who wouldn't believe a man could die of exposure on a July night, but they'd be people who've never spent a few hours 30 feet under the ground, sitting no more than 10 feet above dank island bedrock. I know none of that is pleasant to think of, Dolores, but at least it means you can quit your worrying. Sleep for a while, and when you go back out there, you'll see. I didn't know if that voice was making sense or not, but it seemed to be making sense. And I did try to go to sleep. I couldn't, though. Each time I'd drift a little, I'd think I could hear Joe stumbling his way up the side of the shed toward the back door. And every time the house creaked, I jumped. At last, I couldn't stand it anymore. I took off my dress, put on a pair of jeans and a sweater, locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen, I guess you'd say, and grabbed the flashlight off the bathroom floor from beside the commode where I dropped it when I knelt down to vomit. Then I went back out. It was darker than ever. I don't know if there was any kind of moon that night, but it wouldn't have mattered even if there was, because the clouds had rolled back in again. The closer I got to the blackberry tangle behind the shed, the heavier my feet got. By the time I could see the well cap again in the flashlight beam, it seemed like I couldn't hardly lift them at all. I did, though. I made myself walk right up to it. I stood there listening for almost 5 minutes, and there wasn't a sound but the crickets and the wind rattling through the blackberry bushes and an owl hooty-hooing someplace, probably the exact same one I'd heard before. Oh, and far off to the east, I could hear the waves striking the headland. Only that's a sound you get so used to on the island you don't hardly hear it at all. I stood there with Joe's flashlight in my hand, the beam aimed at the hole in the well cap, feeling greasy, sticky sweat creeping down all over my body, stinging in the cuts and digs the blackberry thorns had made. And I told myself to kneel down and look in the well. After all, wasn't that what I'd come out there to do? It was, but once I was actually out there, I couldn't do it. All I could do was tremble and make a high moaning sound in my throat. My heart wasn't really beating either, but only fluttering in my chest, like a hummingbird's wings. And then a white hand, all streaked with dirt and blood and moss, snaked right out of that well and grabbed my ankle. I dropped the flashlight. It fell in the bushes right at the edge of the well, which was lucky for me. If it had fallen into the well, I'd have been in deep shit indeed. But I wasn't thinking about the flashlight or my good luck, because the shit I was in right then was plenty deep enough. And the only thing I was thinking about was the hand on my ankle. The hand was dragging me toward the hole. That, and a line from the Bible. It clanged in my head like a big iron bell. I have digged a pit for mine enemies and am fallen into it myself. I screamed and tried to pull away, but Joe had me so tight it felt like his hand had been dipped in cement. My eyes had adjusted to the dark enough so I could see him even with the flashlight beam shining off in the wrong direction. He'd almost managed to climb out of the well after all. God knows how many times he must have fallen back, but in the end he got almost to the top. I think he probably would have made it all the way out if I hadn't come back when I did. His head was no more than 2 feet below what was left of the board cap. He was still grinning. His lower plate was stuck out of his mouth a little. I can still see that as clear as I see you sitting across from me right now, Andy. And it looked like a horse's teeth when it grins at you. Some of them looked black with the blood that was on them. Dolores, he panted and kept pulling me. I screamed and fell down on my backside and went sliding toward that damned hole in the ground. I could hear the blackberry thorns ticking and snicking as my jeans went sliding past them and over them. "Dolores, you bitch," he says. But by then it was more like he was singing to me. I remember thinking, pretty soon he'll start in on Moonlight Cocktail. I grabbed at the bushes and got my hands full of stickers and fresh blood. I kicked at his head with a foot he didn't have hold of, but it was just a little too low to hit. I parted his hair with the heel of my sneaker a couple of times, but that was just about all. "Come on, Dolores," he said, like he wanted to take me out for an ice cream soda, or maybe dancing to the country and western over at Fudgy's. My ass fetched up against one of the boards still left on the side of the well, and I knew if I didn't do something right away, we were going to go tumbling down together, and there we'd stay, probably wrapped in each other's arms. And when we was found, there'd be people, ninnies like Yvette Anderson for the most part, who'd say it just went to show how much we loved each other. That did it. I found a little extra strength and give one last tug backward. He almost held on, but then his hand slipped off. My sneaker must have hit him in the face. He screamed. His hand beat at the end of my foot a couple of times, and then it was gone for good. I waited to hear him go tumbling to the bottom. But he didn't. The son of a bitch never gave up. If he'd lived the same way he died, I don't know that we'd ever have had any problems, him and me. I got up on my knees and saw him go swaying backward over the hole, but somehow he held on. He looked up at me, shook a bloody clump of hair out of his eyes, and grinned. Then his hand come up out of the well again and grabbed onto the ground. "Dolores," he kind of groaned. "Dolores, Dolores, Dolores." And then he started to climb out. "Brain him, you ninny," Vera Donovan said then. Not in my head, like the voice of the little girl I seen earlier. Do you understand what I'm saying? I heard that voice just like you three are hearing me now. And if Nancy Bannister's tape recorder had been out there, you could have played that voice back over and over and over again. I know that as well as I know my own name. Anyway, I grabbed one of the stones set into the ground at the edge of the well. He kind of clutched at my wrist, but I pulled the stone free before he could set his grip. It was a big stone, all crusted with dry moss. I raised it over my head. He looked up at it. His head was out of the hole by then, and it looked like his eyes were standing out on stalks. I brought the rock down on him with all my strength. I heard that lower plate of his bust. It sounded like when you drop a china plate on a brick hearth. And then he was gone, tumbling back down the well, and the rock went with him. I fainted then. I don't remember fainting, just laying back and looking up at the sky. There was nothing to see because of the clouds, so I closed my eyes. Only when I opened them, the sky was full of stars again. It took me a little while to realize what had happened, that I'd fainted, and the clouds had blown away while I was passed out. The flashlight was still laying in the brambles beside the well, and the beam was still nice and bright. I picked it up and shone it down into the well. Joe was laying at the bottom, his head cocked over on one shoulder, his hands in his lap and his legs splayed out. The rock I'd brained him with was laying between them. I held the light on him for 5 minutes, waiting to see if he'd move. But he never. Then I got up and made my way back to the house. I had to stop twice when the world went foggy on me, but I finally made it. I walked into the bedroom, taking off my clothes as I went and leaving them just wherever they fell. I got into the shower and only stood there under spray as hot as I could take it for the next 10 minutes or so, not soaping myself, not washing my hair, not doing nothing but standing with my face up so the water'd hit all over it. I think I might have fallen asleep right there in the shower, except the water started to cool off. I washed my hair quick before it could go all the way to stone cold and got out. My arms and legs were all scratched up, and my throat still hurt like hell. But I didn't think I was going to die from none of that. It never occurred to me what somebody might make of all those scratches, not to mention the bruises on my throat, after Joe was found down the well. Not then, at least. I pulled my nightgown on and fell on the bed and went fast asleep with the light on. I woke up screaming less than an hour later with Joe's hand on my ankle. I had a moment of relief when I realized it was only a dream. But then I thought, what if he's climbing the side of the well again? I knew he wasn't. I'd finished him for good when I hit him with that rock and he fell down the second time. But part of me was sure he was, and that he'd be out in another minute or so. Once he was, he'd come for me. I tried to lie there and wait it out, but I couldn't. That picture of him climbing up the side of the well just kept getting clearer and clearer, and my heart was beating so hard it felt like it might explode. Finally, I put on my sneakers, grabbed the flashlight again, and went running out there in my nightgown. I crawled to the edge of the well that time. I couldn't make myself walk, not for nothing. I was too afraid of his white hand snaking up out of the dark and grabbing onto me. At last, I shone the light down. He was laying there, just the same as he had been, with his hands in his lap and his head cocked to one side. The rock was still laying in the same place between his spread legs. I looked for a long time, and when I went back to the house that time, I'd begun to know he was really dead. I crawled into bed, turned off the lamp, and pretty soon I cocked off to sleep. The last thing I remember thinking was, I'll be all right now. But I wasn't. I woke up a couple of hours later, sure I could hear someone in the kitchen. Sure I could hear Joe in the kitchen. I tried to jump out of bed and my feet tangled in the blankets, and I fell on the floor. I got up and started feeling around for the switch on the lamp. Sure, I'd feel his hands slide around my throat before I could find it. That didn't happen, of course. I turned on the light and went through the whole house. It was empty. Then I put on my sneakers and grabbed the flashlight and ran back out to the well. Joe was still laying on the bottom, with his hands in his lap and his head on his shoulder. I had to look at him a long time, though, before I could convince myself it was laying on the same shoulder. And once, I thought I saw his foot move, although that was most likely just a shadow moving. There were lots of those, because the hand holding the flashlight wasn't none too steady, let me tell you. As I crouched there with my hair tied back and probably looking like the lady on the white rock labels, the funniest urge come over me. I felt like just letting myself lean forward on my knees until I tumbled into the well. They'd find me with him. Not the ideal way to finish up, as far as I was concerned, but at least I wouldn't be found with his arms wrapped around me, and I wouldn't have to keep waking up with the idea he was in the room with me, or feeling I had to run back out with the light to check and make sure he was still dead. Then Vera's voice spoke up again. Only this time it was in my head. I know that, just like I know that it spoke right into my ear the first time. The only place you're going to tumble into is your own bed, that voice told me. Get some sleep, and when you wake up, the eclipse really will be over. You'll be surprised how much better things will look with the sun out. That sounded like good advice, and I set out to follow it. I locked both doors to the outside, though, and before I actually got into bed, I did something I ain't never done before, or since. Propped a chair underneath the doorknob. I'm ashamed to admit that. My cheeks feel all hot, so I guess I'm blushing. But it must have helped, because I was asleep the second my head hit the pillow. When I opened my eyes the next time, full daylight was streaming in through the window. Vera had told me to take the day off. She said Gail Levesque could oversee putting the house to rights after the big party she'd been planning for the night of the 20th, and I was some glad. I got up and took another shower and then got dressed. It took me half an hour to do all those things 'cause I was so lamed up. It was my back, mostly. It's been my weak point ever since the night Joe hit me in the kidneys with that stove length. And I'm pretty sure I strained it again, first pulling that rock I clouted him with free of the earth, and then heisting it up over my head the way I did. Whatever it was, I can tell you it hurt a bitch. Once I finally had my clothes on, I sat down at the kitchen table in the bright sunshine and drank a cup of black coffee and thought of the things I ought to do. There wasn't many, even though nothing had gone just the way I'd meant for it to go. But they'd have to be done right. If I forgot something or overlooked something, I'd go to prison. Joe St. George wa'n't much loved on Little Tall, and there weren't many who'd have blamed me for what I did. But they don't pin a medal on you and give you a parade for killing a man, no matter if he was a worthless piece of shit. I poured myself a fresh slug of mud and went out on the back porch to drink it, and to cast my eye around. Both reflector boxes and one of the viewers were back in the grocery sack Vera'd given me. The pieces of the other viewer were laying right where they'd been since Joe jumped up sudden and it slid out of his lap and broke on the porch floor. I thought for a while about whether or not to clean up those pieces of glass. Finally, I went inside, got the broom and the dustpan, and swept 'em up. I decided that being the way I am and so many folks on the island knowing the way I am, it'd be more suspicious if I left 'em laying. I'd started off with the idea of saying I'd never seen Joe at all that afternoon. I thought I'd tell folks he'd been gone when I got home from Vera's, without so much as a note left behind to say where he'd taken his country butt off to, and that I'd poured that bottle of expensive Scotch whiskey out on the ground 'cause I was mad at him. If they did tests that showed he was drunk when he fell into the well, it wouldn't bother me none. Joe could have gotten booze lots of places, including under our own kitchen sink. One look into the mirror convinced me that wouldn't do. If Joe hadn't been home to put those bruises on my neck, then they'd want to know who had put 'em there. And what was I going to say? Santa Claus did it? Luckily, I'd left myself an out. I'd told Vera that if Joe started acting out the tartar, probably I'd leave him to stew in his own sauce and watch the eclipse from East Head. I hadn't had any plan in mind when I said those words, but I blessed 'em now. East Head itself wouldn't do. There'd been people there, and they'd know I hadn't been with 'em. But Russian Meadows on the way to East Head, and it's got a good western view, and there hadn't been nobody at all there. I'd seen that for myself from my seat on the porch, and again while I was washing up our dishes. The only real question... What, Frank? Oh, I weren't worried a bit about his truck being at the house. He had a string of 3 or 4 DWIs right close together back in 59, you see, and finally lost his driver's license for a month. Edgar Sherrick, who was our constable back then, came around and told him he could drink until the cows came home if that was what he wanted, but the next time he got caught drinking and driving, Edgar'd hoe him into district court and try to get his driver's license lifted for a year. Edgar and his wife lost a little girl to a drunk driver back in 1948 or 49, and although he was an easy-going man about other things, he was death on drunks behind the wheel. Joe knew it, and he quit driving if he'd had more'n 2 drinks right after him and Edgar had their little talk on our porch. No, when I came back from Russian Meadow and found Joe gone, I thought one of his friends must have come by and taken him someplace to celebrate Eclipse Day. That was the story I meant to tell. What I started to say was the only real question I had was what to do about the whiskey bottle. People knew I'd been buying him his drink just lately, but that was all right. I knew they thought I'd been doing it so he'd lay off hitting me. But where would that bottle have ended up if the story I was making up had been a true story? It might not matter, but then again it might. When you've done a murder, you never know what may come back to haunt you later on. It's the best reason I know not to do it. I'd been so much as a sip of whiskey left in that bottle. It had to go down the well with him. And that's where it did go, all but the cap, that was. That I dropped into the swill on top of the little pile of broken tinted glass. I walked out to the well with the last of the scotch swishing in the bottle, thinking, he put the old booze to him, and that was all right. That was no more'n what I expected. But then he kind of mistook my neck for a pump handle. and that wa'n't all right. So I took my reflector box and went up to Russian Meadow by myself, cursing the impulse that made me stop and buy him that bottle of Johnny Walker in the first place. When I got back, he was gone. I didn't know where or who with, and I didn't care. I just cleared up his mess and hoped he'd be in better frame of mind when he got back. I thought that sounded meek enough, and that it'd pass muster. I guess what I mostly disliked about that goddamn bottle was getting rid of it meant going back out there and looking at Joe again. Still, my likes and dislikes didn't make a whole lot of difference by then. I was worried about the state the blackberry bushes might be in, but they wasn't trampled down as bad as I'd been afraid they might be, and some were springing back already. I figured they'd look pretty much like always by the time I reported Joe missing. I'd hoped the well wouldn't look quite so scary in broad daylight, but it did. The hole in the middle of the cap looked even creepier. It didn't look so much like an eye with some of the boards pulled back, but not even that helped. Instead of an eye, it looked like an empty socket, where something had finally rotted so bad it had fallen completely out, and I could smell that dank, coppery smell. It made me think of the girl I'd glimpsed in my mind, and I wondered how she was doing on the morning after. I had an idea she probably had her own covering up to do. I wanted to turn around and go back to the house, but I marched right up to the well instead, without so much as a single dragged foot. I wanted to get the next part behind me as soon as I could and not look back. What I had to do from then on out, Andy, was to think about my kids and keep faced front no matter what. I scooched down and looked in. Joe was still laying there with his hands in his lap and his head cocked over on one shoulder. There was bugs running around on his face. And it was seeing those that made me know once and for good that he really was dead. I held the bottle out with a hanky wrapped around the neck. It wasn't a question of fingerprints. I just didn't want to touch it. And dropped it. It landed in the mud beside him, but didn't break. The bugs scattered, though. They ran down his neck and into the collar of his shirt. I never forget that. I was getting up to leave. The sight of those bugs diving for cover had left me feeling pukey again. When my eye fixed on the jumble of boards I'd pulled up so I could get a look at him that first time, it wasn't no good leaving him there. They'd raise all sorts of questions if I did. I thought about him for a little while, and then, when I realized the morning was slipping away on me, and somebody might drop by any time to talk about either the eclipse or Vera's big doings, I said to hell with it and threw him down the well. Then I went back to the house, worked my way back to the house, I should say, because there were pieces of my dress and slip hanging from a good many thorns, and I picked off as many as I could. Later on that day, I went back and picked off the 3 or 4 I missed the first time. There were little bits of fluff from Joe's flannel shirt, too, but I left those. Let Garrett Thibodeau make anything of him he can, I thought. Let anyone make anything of him they can. It's going to look like he got drunk and fell down the well no matter what. And with the reputation Joe's got around here, whatever they decide on will most likely go in my favor. Those little pieces of cloth didn't go in the swill with the broken glass and the Johnny Walker cap, though. Those I threw in the ocean later on that day. I was across the dooryard and getting ready to climb the porch steps when a thought hit me. Joe had grabbed onto the piece of my slip that had been trailing out behind me. Suppose he still had a piece of it. Suppose it was clutched in one of the hands that was laying curled up in his lap at the bottom of the well. That stopped me cold. And cold's just what I mean. I stood there in the dooryard under that hot July sun, my back all prickles and feeling zero at the bone, as some poem I read in high school said. Then Vera spoke up inside my mind again. "Since you can't do anything about it, Dolores," she says, "I'd advise you to let it go." It seemed like pretty good advice, so I went on up the steps and back inside. I spent most of the morning walking around the house and out on the porch, looking for, Well, I don't know. I don't know what I was looking for exactly. Maybe I was expecting that inside eye to happen on something else that needed to be done or taken care of, the way it had happened on that little pile of boards. If so, I didn't see anything. Around 11 o'clock, I took the next step, which was calling Gail Levesque up at Pinewood. I asked her what she thought of the eclipse and all, then asked how things were going over at her Nibs. Well, she says, I can't complain since I haven't seen nobody but that older fellow with the bald head and the toothbrush mustache. Do you know the one I mean? I said I did. He come downstairs about 9:30, went out back in the garden, walking slow and kind of holding his head, but at least up, which is more than you can say for the rest of them. When Karen Jolander asked him if he'd like a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice, he ran over to the edge of the porch and puked in the petunias. You should have heard him, Dolores. Blech! I laughed until I almost cried, and no laughter ever felt better to me. They must have had quite a party when they got back from the ferry, Gail says. If I had a nickel for every cigarette butt I've dumped this morning, just a nickel, mind you, I could buy a brand new Chevrolet. But I'll have the place spick and spiffy by the time Mrs. Donovan drags her hangover down the front stairs. You can count on that. I know you will, I says. And if you need any help, you know who to call, don't you? Gail gave a laugh at that. Never mind, she says. You worked your fingers to the bone over the last week, and Mrs. Donovan knows it as well as I do. She don't want to see you before tomorrow morning, and neither do I. All right, I says. And then I took a little pause. She'd be expecting me to say goodbye. And when I said something else instead, she'd pay particular mind to it, which was what I wanted. You haven't seen Joe over there, have you? I asked her. Joe, she says. You're Joe? Yeah. No, I've never seen him up here. Why do you ask? He didn't come home last night. Oh, Dolores, she says, sounding horrified and interested at the same time. Drinking? "'Course,' I says. "'Not that I'm really worried. "'This ain't the first time he stayed out all night howling at the moon. "'He'll turn up. "'Bad pennies always do.' "'Then I hung up, feeling I'd done a pretty fair job planting the first seed. "'I made myself a toasted cheese sandwich for lunch, then couldn't eat it. "'The smell of the cheese and fried bread made my stomach feel all hot and sweaty. "'I took two aspirins instead and laid down.' I didn't think I'd fall asleep, but I did. When I woke up, it was almost 4 o'clock, and time to plant a few more seeds. I called Joe's friends, those few that had phones, that is, and asked each one if they'd seen him. He hadn't come home last night, I said, and still weren't home, and I was starting to get worried. They all told me no, of course, and every one of them wanted to hear all the gory details. But the only one I said anything to was Tommy Anderson, probably because I knew Joe'd bragged to Tommy before about how he kept his woman in line, and poor simple Tommy had swallowed it. Even there, I was careful not to overdo it. I just said me and Joe'd had an argument, and Joe'd most likely gone off mad. I made a few more calls that evening, including a few to people I'd already called, and was happy to find that stories was already starting to spread. I didn't sleep very well that night. I had terrible dreams. One was about Joe. He was standing at the bottom of the well, looking up at me with his white face and those dark circles above his nose that made him look like he'd pushed big lumps of coal into his eyes. He said he was lonely, and kept begging me to jump down into the well with him and keep him company. The other one was worse, because it was about Selena. She was about 4 years old and wearing the pink dress her grandma Tricia bought her just before she died. Selena come up to me in the dooryard, and I saw she had my sewing scissors in her hand. I put out my hand for 'em, but she just shook her head. "It's my fault, and I'm the one who has to pay," she said. Then she raised the scissors to her face and cut off her own nose with 'em. Snip! It fell into the dirt between her little black patent leather shoes, and I woke up screaming. It was only 4 o'clock, but I was all done sleeping that night, and not too stupid to know it. At 7, I called Vera's again. This time her pet hunky answered, Kenopensky. I told him I knew Vera was expecting me that morning, but I couldn't come in, at least not till I found out where my husband was. I said he'd gone missing 2 nights, and 1 night out drunk had always been his limit before. Near the end of our talk, Vera herself picked up on the extension and asked me what was going on. I seem to have misplaced my husband, I said. She didn't say nothing for a few seconds, and I would have given a pie to know what she was thinking of. Then she spoke up and said that if she'd been in my place, misplacing Joe St. George wouldn't have bothered her at all. Well, I says, we've got 3 kids, and I've kind of got used to him. I'll be in later on if he turns up. That's fine, she says. And then, are you still there, Ted? Yes, Vera, says he. Well, go do something manly, she says. Pound something in or push something over. I don't care which. Yes, Vera, he repeats, and there was a little click on the line as he hung up. Vera was quiet for a couple of more seconds, just the same. Then she says, maybe he's had an accident, Dolores. Yes, I says, it wouldn't surprise me none. He's been drinking heavy the last few weeks, and when I tried to talk to him about the kid's money on the day of the eclipse, he damn near choked the life out of me. Oh, really? She says. Another couple of seconds went by, and then she said, good luck, Dolores. Thanks, I says. I may need it. If there's anything I can do, let me know. That's very kind, I told her. Not at all, she says back. I'd simply hate to lose you. It's hard to find help these days who doesn't sweep the dirt under the carpets. Not to mention help that can remember to put the welcome mats back down pointing in the right direction, I thought, but didn't say. I only thanked her and hung up. I gave it another half hour, then I rang Garrett Thibodeau. Wasn't nothing so fancy and modern as a police chief on Little Tall in those days. Garrett was the town constable. He took over the job when Edgar Sherrick had his stroke back in 1960. I told him Joe hadn't been home the last 2 nights, and I was getting worried. Garrett sounded pretty muzzy. I don't think he'd been up long enough to have gotten outside his first cup of coffee yet. But he said he'd contact the state police on the mainland and check with a few people on the island. I knew they'd be all the same people I'd already called, twice in some cases. But I didn't say so. Garrett finished by saying he was sure I'd see Joe by lunchtime. That's right, you old fart, I thought, hanging up. And pigs'll whistle. I guess that man did have brains enough to sing Yankee Doodle while he took a shit, but I doubt if he could have remembered all the words. It was a whole damned week before they found him, and I was half out of my mind before they did. Selina came back on Wednesday. I called her late Tuesday afternoon to say her father had gone missing, and it was starting to look serious. I asked her if she wanted to come home, and she said she did. Melissa Caron, Tanya's mother, you know, went and fetched her. I left the boys right where they were. Just dealing with Selina was enough for a start. She caught me out in my little vegetable garden on Thursday, still 2 days before they finally found Joe. And she says, Mama, tell me something. All right, dear, I says. I think I sounded calm enough, but I had a pretty good idea of what was coming. Oh, yes, indeed. Did you do anything to him? She asks. All of a sudden my dream come back to me. Selina at 4, in her pretty pink dress, raising up my sewing scissors and cutting off her own nose. And I thought, prayed, God, please help me lie to my daughter. Please, God, I'll never ask you for nothing again. If you'll just help me lie to my daughter so she'll believe me and never doubt. No, I says. I was wearing my gardening gloves, but I took them off so I could put my bare hands on her shoulders. I looked her dead in the eye. No, Selina, I told her. He was drunk and ugly, and he choked me hard enough to leave these bruises on my neck, but I didn't do nothing to him. All I did was leave, and I did that because I was scared to stay. You can understand that, can't you? Understand and not blame me? You know what it's like, to be scared of him, don't you? She nodded, but her eyes never left mine. They were a darker blue than I'd ever seen them, the color of the ocean just ahead of a squall line. In my mind's eye, I saw the blades of the scissors flashing, and her little button of a nose falling plop into the dust. And I'll tell you what I think. I think God granted half my prayer that day. It's how he usually answers them, I've noticed. No lie I told about Joe later was any better than the one I told Selina that hot July afternoon amongst the beans and cukes. But did she believe me? Believe me and never doubt? As much as I'd like to think the answer to that is yes, I can't. It was doubt that made her eyes so dark, then and ever after. The worst I'm guilty of, I says, is buying him a bottle of booze, of trying to bribe him to be nice when I should have known better. She looked at me a minute longer, then bent down and took hold of the bag of cucumbers I'd picked. All right, she said. I'll take these in the house for you. And that was all. We never spoke of it again, not before they found him and not after. She must have heard plenty of talk about me, both on the island and at school, but we never spoke of it again. That was when the coldness started to come in, though, that afternoon in the garden, and when the first crack in the wall families put between themselves and the rest of the world showed up between us. Since then, it's only gotten wider and wider. She calls me twice a month. She's good about that. But we're apart just the same. We are estranged. What I did was mostly done for Selina, not for the boys or because of the money her dad tried to steal. It was mostly for Selina that I led him on to his death. And all it cost me to protect her from him was the deepest part of her love for me. I once heard my own dad say that God pitched a bitch on the day he made the world. And over the years, I've come to understand what he meant. And you know the worst of it. Sometimes it's funny. Sometimes it's so funny you can't help from laughing, even while it's all fallen apart around you. Meantime, Garrett Thibodeau and his barbershop cronies kept busy not finding Joe. It had gotten to the point where I thought I'd just have to stumble on him myself, as little as I liked the idea. If it hadn't been for the dough, I'd have been happy to leave him down there until the last trump blew. But the money was over there in Jonesport, sitting in a bank account with his name on it, and I didn't fancy waiting 7 years to have him declared legally dead so I could get it back. Selina was going to be starting college in just a little over 2 years, and she'd want some of that money to get herself going. The idea that Joe might have taken his bottle into the woods behind the house and either stepped in a trap or taken a fall walking home tipsy in the dark finally started to go the rounds. Garrett claimed it was his idea, but that's awful hard for me to believe, having gone to school with him like I did. He put a sign-up sheet on the door of the town hall Thursday afternoon, and on Saturday morning, a week after the eclipse this was, he fielded a search party of 40 or 50 men. They formed up a line by the east head end of Highgate Woods and worked their way toward the house, first through the woods and then across Russian Meadow. I seen them crossing the meadow in a long line around 1 o'clock, laughing and joking. But the joking stopped and the cursing begun when they crossed over onto our property and got into the blackberry tangle. I stood in the entry door, watching them come with my heart beating way up in my throat. I remember thinking that at least Selina weren't home. She'd gone over to see Laurie Langle, and that was a blessing. Then I started thinking that all those brambles would cause them to just say frigate and break off the search before they got anywhere near the old well. But they kept on coming. All at once I heard Sonny Benoit scream, "Hey, Garrett, over here! Get over here!" And I knew that, for better or worse, Joe had been found. There was an autopsy, of course. They did it the very day they found him, and I guess it might have still been going on when Jack and Alicia Forbert brought the boys back around dusk. Pete was crying, but he looked all confused. I don't think he really understood what had happened to his dad. Joe Jr. did, though. And when he drew me aside, I thought he was going to ask me the same question Selina had asked, and I steeled myself to tell the same lie. But he asked me something entirely different. "Ma," he says, "if I was glad he was dead, would God send me to hell?" "Joey, a person can't much help his feelings, and I think God knows that," I said. Then he started to cry, and he said something that broke my heart. "I tried to love him," is what he told me. "I always tried, but he wouldn't let me." I swept him into my arms and hugged him as hard as I could. I think that was about as close as I come to crying in the whole business. But of course you have to remember that I hadn't been sleeping too well and still hadn't the slightest idea of how things was going to play out. There was to be an inquest on Tuesday, and Lucien Mercier, who ran the only mortuary on Little Tall back then, told me I'd finally be allowed to bury Joe in the Oaks on Wednesday. But on Monday, the day before the inquest, Garrett called me on the telephone and asked if I could come down to his office for a few minutes. It was the call I'd been expecting and dreading, but there wasn't nothing to do but go. So I asked Alicia if she'd keep an eye on the kids, and then I went. Garrett wasn't alone. Dr. John McAuliffe was with him. I'd more or less expected that, too, but my heart still sank a little in my breast. McAuliffe was the county medical examiner back then. He died 3 years later when a snowplow hit his little Volkswagen Beetle. It was Henry Brierton took over the job when McAuliffe died. If Brierton had been the county man in 63, I'd have felt a good deal easier in my mind about our little talk that day. Brierton's smarter than poor old Garrett Thibodeau was, but only by a horsehair or so. John McAuliffe, though, he had a mind like the lamp that shines out a Batiscan light. He was a genuine bottled-in bond Scotsman who turned up in these parts right after World War II ended, hootmon, burr and all. I guess he must have been an American citizen, since he was both doctoring and holding a county position, but he sure didn't sound much like folks from around here. Not that it mattered to me. I knew I'd have to face him down, no matter if he was an American or a Scotsman or a heathen Chinee. He had snowy white hair, even though he couldn't have been more than 45, and blue eyes so bright and sharp they looked like drill bits. When he looked at you, you felt like he was staring right into your head and putting the thoughts he saw there into alphabetical order. As soon as I seen him sitting beside Garrett's desk and heard the door to the rest of the town office building click closed behind me, I knew that what happened the next day over on the mainland didn't matter at Tinker's Dam. The real inquest was going to happen right there in that tiny town constable's office with a Weber oil calendar hanging on one wall and a picture of Garrett's mother hanging on another. "I'm sorry to bother you in your time of grief, Dolores," Garrett said. He was rubbing his hands together, kind of nervous, and he reminded me of Mr. Pease over at the bank. Garrett must have had a few more calluses on his hands, though, because the sound they made going back and forth was like fine sandpaper rubbing along a dry board. "But Dr. McAuliffe here has a few questions he'd like to ask you." I seen by the puzzled way Garrett looked at the doc that he didn't know what those questions might be, though, and that scared me even more. I didn't like the idea of that canny Scotsman thinking matters were serious enough for him to keep his own counsels and not give poor old Garrett Thibodeau any chance at all to frig up the works. "My deepest sympathies, Mrs. St. George," McAuliffe says in that thick Scots accent of his. He was a little man, but compact and well put together for all that. He had a neat little mustache, as white as the hair on his head. He was wearing a three-piece wool suit, and he didn't look no more like home folks than he sounded like them. Those blue eyes went drilling away at my forehead, and I seen he didn't have a bit of sympathy for me, no matter what he was saying. Probably not for nobody else either, including himself. "I'm very, very sorry for your grief and misfortune." "Sure, and if I believe that, you'll tell me one more," I thought. The last time you was really sorry, Doc, was the last time you needed to use the pay toilet and the string on your pet dime broke. But I made up my mind right then that I wasn't going to show him how scared I was. Maybe he had me and maybe he didn't. You got to remember that for all I knew, he was going to tell me that when they laid Joe on the table there in the basement of County Hospital and opened his hands, a little piece of white nylon fell out of one. A scrid of a lady's slip. That could be, all right. But I still wasn't going to give him the satisfaction of squirming under his eyes. And he was used to having people squirm when he looked at him. He'd come to take it as his due. And he liked it. Thank you very much, I said. Will you sit down, madam? He asks, like it was his office instead of poor old confused Garrett's. I sat down, and he asked me if I'd kindly give him permission to smoke. I told him the lamp was lit as far as I was concerned. He chuckled like I'd made a funny, but his eyes didn't chuckle. He took a big old black pipe out of his coat pocket, a briar, and stoked it up. His eyes never left me while he was doing it either. Even after he had it clamped between his teeth and the smoke was rising out of the bowl, he never took his eyes off me. They gave me the willies, peering at me through the smoke like they did, and made me think of Batiscan Light again. They say that one shines out almost 2 miles, even on a night when the fog's thick enough to carve with your hands. I started to squirm under that look of his in spite of all my good intentions, and then I thought of Vera Donovan saying, "Nonsense. Husbands die every day, Dolores." It occurred to me that McAuliffe could stare at Vera until his eyes fell out and never get her to so much as cross her legs the other way. Thinking of that eased me a little, and I grew quiet again. Just folded my hands on top of my handbag and waited him out. At last, when he seen I wasn't going to fall out of my chair onto the floor and confess to murdering my husband, through a rain of tears is how he would have liked it, I imagine, he took the pipe out of his mouth and said, "You told the constable 'twas your husband who put those bruises on your neck, Mrs. St. George." "Aye," I says, "that you and he had sat down on the porch to watch the eclipse, and there commenced an argument." "Aye." "And what, may I ask, was the argument about?" "Money on top," I says, "booze underneath. But you yourself bought him the liquor he got drunk on that day, Mrs. St. George. Isn't that right?" "Aye," I says. I could feel myself wanting to say something more to explain myself, but I didn't, even though I could. That's what McAuliffe wanted, you see, for me to go on rushing ahead, to explain myself right into a jail cell someplace. At last he gave up waiting. He twiddled his fingers like he was annoyed, then fixed those lighthouse eyes of his on me again. "After the choking incident, you left your husband. You went up to Russian Meadow on the way to East Head to watch the eclipse by yourself." "Aye." He leaned forward all of a sudden, his little hands on his little knees, and says, "Mrs. St. George, do you know what direction the wind was from that day?" It was like the day in November of 62 when I almost found the old well by falling into it. I seemed to hear the same cracking noise, and I thought, "You be careful, Dolores Claiborne. You be oh so careful. There's wells everywhere today, and this man knows where every goddamn one of 'em is." "No," I says, "I don't. And when I don't know where the wind's quartering from, that usually means the day's calm." "Actually, wasn't much more than a breeze," Garrett started to say, but McAuliffe raised his hand and cut him off like a knife blade. "It was out of the west," he said. "A west wind, a west breeze, if you so prefer. 7 to 9 miles an hour with gusts up to 15. It seems strange to me, Mrs. St. George, that the wind didn't bring your husband's cries to you as you stood in Russian Meadow, not half a mile away." I didn't say anything for at least 3 seconds. I'd made up my mind that I'd count to three inside my head before I answered any of his questions. Doing that might keep me from moving too quick and paying for it by falling into one of the pits he'd dug for me. But McAuliffe must have thought he had me confused from the word go, because he leaned forward in his chair, and I'll declare and vow that for 1 or 2 seconds there, his eyes went from blue hot to white hot. "It don't surprise me," I says. "For one thing, 7 miles an hour ain't much more'n a puff of air on a muggy day. For another, there were about 1,000 boats out on the reach, all tootin' to each other. And how do you know he called out at all? You sure as hell didn't hear him." He sat back, looking a little disappointed. "It's a reasonable deduction to make," he says. "We know the fall itself didn't kill him, and the forensic evidence strongly suggests that he had at least one extended period of consciousness. Mrs. St. George, if you fell into a disused well and found yourself with a broken shin, a broken ankle, 4 broken ribs, and a sprained wrist, wouldn't you call for aid and succor?" I gave it 3 seconds with a My Pretty Pony between each one, and then said, "It wasn't me who fell down the well, Dr. McAuliffe. It was Joe, and he'd been drinking." "Yes," Dr. McAuliffe comes back. "You bought him a bottle of Scotch whiskey, even though everyone I've spoken to says you hated it when he drank. Even though he became unpleasant and argumentative when he drank, you bought him a bottle of Scotch. And he had not just been drinking, he was drunk. He was very drunk. His mouth was also filled with blood, and his shirt was matted with blood, all the way down to his belt buckle. When you combine the fact of this blood with a knowledge of the broken ribs and the concomitant lung injuries he had sustained, do you know what that suggests?" 1, My Pretty Pony. 2, My Pretty Pony. 3, My Pretty Pony. "Nope," I says. "Several of the fractured ribs had punctured his lungs. Such injuries always result in bleeding, but rarely bleeding this extensive. Bleeding of this sort was probably caused, I deduce, by the deceased crying repeatedly for rescue." That was how he said it, Andy. Rescue. It wasn't a question, but I counted 3 all the same before saying, "You think he was down there calling for help? That's what it all comes to, ain't it?" "No, madam," he says. "I do not just think so. I have a moral certainty." This time I didn't take no weight. "Dr. McAuliffe," I says, "do you think I pushed my husband down into that well?" That shook him up a little. Those lighthouse eyes of his not only blinked for a few seconds there, they dulled right over. He fiddled and diddled with his pipe some more, then stuck it back in his mouth and drew on it, all the time trying to decide how he should handle that. Before he could, Garrett spoke up. His face had gone as red as a radish. "Dolores," he says, "I'm sure no one thinks, that is to say, that no one has even considered the idea that..." "Aye," McAuliffe breaks in. I'd put his train of thought off on a siding for a few seconds, but I saw he'd got it back onto the main line without no real trouble. "I've considered it. You'll understand, Mrs. St. George, that part of my job..." "Oh, never mind no more, Mrs. St. George," I says. "If you're going to accuse me of first pushing my husband down the well and then standing over him while he screamed for help, you go right on ahead and call me Dolores." I wasn't exactly trying to plink in that time, Andy, but I'll be damned if I didn't do it anyway. 2nd time in as many minutes. I doubt he'd been used that hard since medical school. "Nobody is accusing you of anything, Mrs. St. George," he says, all stiff-like. And what I seen in his eyes was, "Not yet, anyway." "Well, that's good," I says, "because the idea of me pushing Joe down the well is just silly, you know. He outweighed me by at least 50 pounds, probably a fairish bit more. He larded up considerable the last few years. Also, he weren't afraid to use his fists if somebody crossed him or got in his way. I'm telling you that as his wife of 16 years, and you'll probably find plenty of people on the island who tell you the same thing." Of course, Joe hadn't hit me in a long while, but I'd never tried to correct the general impression on the island that he made a pretty steady business of it. And right then, with McAuliffe's blue eyes trying to bore in through my forehead, I was damn glad of it. "Nobody is saying you pushed him into the well," the Scotsman said. He was backing up fast now. I could see by his face that he knew he was, but didn't have no idea how it had happened. His face said that I was the one who was supposed to be backing up. "But he must have been crying out, you know. He must have done it for some time. Hours, perhaps. And quite loudly, too." One, my pretty pony. Two, my pretty pony. Three. "Maybe I'm getting you now," I says. "Maybe you think he fell into the well by accident, and I heard him yelling and just turned a deaf ear. Is that what you've been getting at?" I seen by his face that that was exactly what he'd been getting at. I also seen he was mad things weren't going the way he'd expected them to go, the way they'd always gone before when he had these little interviews. A tiny ball of bright red color had showed up in each of his cheeks. I was glad to see him, because I wanted him mad. A man like McAuliffe is easier to handle when he's mad, because men like him are used to keeping their composure while other people lose theirs. "Mrs. St. George, it will be very difficult to accomplish anything of value here if you keep responding to my questions with questions of your own." "Why, you didn't ask a question, Dr. McAuliffe," I says, popping my eyes wide and innocent. "You told me Joe must have been yelling, crying out was what you actually said. So I just asked if..."
All right," he says,
and put his pipe down in Garrett's brass ashtray, hard enough to make it clang. Now his eyes were blazing, and he'd grown a red stripe across his forehead to go along with the balls of color in his cheeks.
"Did you hear him calling for help, Mrs. St. George?"
One, my pretty pony. Two, my pretty pony. "John, I hardly think there's any call to badger the woman," Garrett broke in, sounding more uncomfortable than ever. And damn if it didn't break that little bandbox Scotsman's concentration again. I almost laughed right out loud. It would have been bad for me if I had. I don't doubt it. But it was a near thing all the same. McAuliffe whipped around and says to Garrett, "You agreed to let me handle this." Poor old Garrett jerked back in his chair as fast he almost tipped it over. And I'm sure he gave himself a whiplash. "Okay, okay, no need to get hot under the collar," he mumbles. McAuliffe turned back to me, ready to repeat the question, but I didn't bother letting him. By then I'd had time to count to 10 pretty near. "No," I says, "I didn't hear nothing but people out on the reach, tooting their boat horns and yelling their fool heads off once they could see the eclipse had started to happen." He waited for me to say some more. His old trick of being quiet and letting people rush ahead into the pucker brush. And the silence spun out between us. I just kept my hands folded on top of my handbag and let her spin. He looked at me, and I looked back at him.
"You're going to talk to me, woman," his eyes said. "You're going to tell me everything I want to hear, twice, if that's the way I want it."
And my own eyes were saying back, "No, I ain't, chummy. You can sit there drilling on me with those diamond-bit baby blues of yours until hell's a skating rink, and you won't get another word out of me unless you open your mouth and ask for it." We went on that way for damn near a full minute, dueling with our eyes, you might say. And toward the end of it, I could feel myself weakening, wanting to say something to him, even if it was only, "Didn't your ma ever teach you it ain't polite to stare?" Then Garrett spoke up, or rather his stomach did. It let out a long groing sound. McAuliffe looked at him, disgusted as hell, and Garrett got out his pocket knife and started to clean under his fingernails. McAuliffe pulled a notebook from the inside pocket of his wool coat. Wool? In July? Looked at something in it, then put it back.
"He tried to climb out,"
he says at last, as casual as a man might say, "I've got a lunch appointment." It felt like somebody had jabbed a meat fork into my lower back.
where Joe hit me with a stove link that time, but I tried not to show it. "Oh, eh?" I says. "Yes," McAuliffe says. "The shaft of the well is lined with large stones, only he said stains, Andy, like they do. And we found bloody handprints on several of them. It appears that he gained his feet, then slowly began to make his way up, hand over hand. It must have been a Herculean effort, made despite a pain more excruciating than I can imagine." "I'm sorry to hear he suffered," I said. My voice was as calm as ever, at least I think it was. But I could feel the sweat starting to break in my armpits, and I remember being scared it would spring out on my brow or in the little hollows of my temples where he could see it. "Poor old Joe." "Yes, indeed," McAuliffe says, his lighthouse eyes boring and flashing away. "Poor old Joe. I think he might have actually gotten out on his own. He probably would have died soon after, even if he had. But yes, I think he might have gotten out. Something prevented him from doing so, however." "What was it?" I asked. "He suffered a fractured skull," McAuliffe said. His eyes were as bright as ever, but his voice had become as soft as a purring cat. "We found a large rock between his legs. It was covered with your husband's blood, Mrs. St. George. And in that blood, we found a small number of porcelain fragments. Do you know what I deduce from them?" 1, 2, 3. "Sounds like that rock must have busted his false teeth as well as his head," I says. "Too bad. Joe was partial to him. And I don't know how Lucian Mercier is going to make him look just right for the viewing without him." McAuliffe's lips drew back when I said that, and I got a good look at his teeth. No dentures there. I suppose he meant it to look like a smile, but it didn't, not a bit. "Yes," he says, showing me both rows of his neat little teeth all the way to the gum line. "Yes, that's my conclusion as well. Those porcelain shards are from his lower plate. Now, Mrs. St. George, do you have any idea of how that rock might have come to strike your husband just as he was on the verge of escaping the well?" 1, 2, 3. "Nope," I says. "Do you?" "Yes," he says. "I rather suspect someone pulled it out of the earth and smashed it cruelly and with malice aforethought onto his upturned, pleading face." Wasn't nobody said anything after that. I wanted to, God knows. I wanted to jump in as quick as ever I could and say, "It wasn't me. Maybe somebody did it, but it wasn't me." I couldn't, though, because I was back in the blackberry tangles, and this time there was friggin' wells every place. Instead of talking, I just sat there looking at him. But I could feel the sweat trying to break out on me again, and I could feel my clasped hands wanting to lock down on each other. The fingernails would turn white if they did that, and he'd notice. McAuliffe was a man built to notice such things. It'd be another chink to shine his version of the Batiscan light into. I tried to think of Vera and how she would have looked at him, as if he was only a little dab of dog shit on one of her shoes. But with his eyes boring into me like they was just then, it didn't seem to do any good. Before, it had been like she was almost there in the room with me. But it wasn't like that anymore. Now there was no one there but me and that neat little Scots doctor, who probably fancied himself just like the amateur detectives in the magazine stories, and whose testimony had already sent over a dozen people up and down the coast to jail, I found out later. And I could feel myself getting closer and closer to opening my mouth and blurting something out. And the hell of it was, Andy, I didn't have the slightest idea what it'd be when it finally came. I could hear the clock on Garrett's desk ticking. It had a big hollow sound. And I was gonna say something when the one person I'd forgot, Garrett Thibodeau, spoke up instead. He spoke in a worried, fast voice, and I realized he couldn't stand no more of that silence either. He must have thought it was gonna go on until somebody had to scream just to relieve the tension. "Now, John," he says, "I thought we agreed that if Joe pulled on that stone just right, it could have come out on its own, and, Mon, will you not shut up?" McAuliffe yelled at him in a high, frustrated sort of voice, and I relaxed. It was all over. I knew it. And I believe that little Scotsman knew it, too. It was like the two of us had been in a black room together, and him tickling my face with what might have been a razor blade. And then clumsy old Constable Thibodeau stubbed his toe, fell against the window, and the shade went up with a bang and a rattle, letting in the daylight. And I seen it was only a feather he'd been touching me with after all. Garrett muttered something about how there was no call for McAuliffe to talk to him that way, but the doc didn't pay him no mind. He turned back to me and said, "Well, Mrs. St. George," in a hard way, like he had me in a corner. But by then we both knew better. All he could do was hope I'd make a mistake. But I had three kids to think about, and having kids makes you careful. "I've told you what I know," I says. "He got drunk while we were waiting for the eclipse. I made him a sandwich, thinking it might sober him up a little, but it didn't. He got yelling, then he choked me and battered me around a little, so I went up to Russian Meadow. When I come back, he was gone. I thought he'd gone off with one of his friends. But he was down the well all the time. I suppose he was trying to take a shortcut out to the road. He might even have been looking for me, wanting to apologize. That's something I won't never know, and maybe it's just as well." I give him a good hard look. "You might try a little of that medicine yourself, Dr. McAuliffe."
"Never mind your advice, madam," McAuliffe says, and those spots of color in his cheeks were burning brighter and hotter than ever. "Are you glad he's dead? Tell me that."
"What in holy tarnal hell has that got to do with what happened to him?" I asked. "Jesus Christ, what's wrong with you?"
He didn't answer, just picked up his pipe in a hand that was shaking the tiniest little bit, and went to work lighting it again. He never asked another question. The last question that was asked of me that day was asked by Garrett Thibodeau. McAuliffe didn't ask it, because it didn't matter, at least not to him. It meant something to Garrett, though, and it meant even more to me, because nothing was going to end when I walked out of the town office building that day. In some ways, me walking out was going to be just the beginning. That last question and the way I answered it mattered plenty, because it's usually the things that wouldn't mean squat in a courtroom that get whispered about the most, over back fences while women hang out their wash, or out on the lobster boats while men are sitting with their backs against the pilot house and eating their lunches. Those things may not send you to prison, but they can hang you in the eyes of the town. "Why in God's name did you buy him a bottle of liquor in the first place?" Garrett kind of bleated. "What got into you, Dolores?"
"I thought he'd leave me alone if he had something to drink," I said. "I thought we could sit together in peace and watch the eclipse and he'd leave me alone." I didn't cry, not really, but I felt one tear go rolling down my cheek. I sometimes think that's the reason I was able to go on living on Little Tall for the next 30 years, that one single tear. If not for that, they might have driven me out with their whispering and carping and pointing at me from behind their hands. Yeah, in the end they might have. I'm tough, but I don't know if anyone's tough enough to stand up to 30 years of gossip and little anonymous notes saying things like, "You got away with murder." I did get a few of those, and I got a pretty good idea of who sent them, too, although that ain't neither here nor there at this late date. But they stopped by the time school let back in that fall.
And so I guess you could say that I owe all the rest of my life, including this part here, to that single tear. And to Garrett putting the word out that in the end I hadn't been too stony-hearted to cry for Joe. There wasn't nothing calculated about it either. And don't you go thinking there was. I was thinking about how sorry I was that Joe'd suffered, the way the little bandbox Scotsman said he had. In spite of everything he'd done and how I'd come to hate him since I'd first found out what he was trying to do to Selina, I'd never intended for him to suffer. I thought the fall'd kill him. Andy, I swear on the name of God, I thought the fall'd kill him outright. Poor old Garrett Thibodeau went as red's a stop sign. He fumbled a wad of Kleenex out of the box of them on his desk and kind of groped it out at me without looking. I imagine he thought that first tear meant I was going to go a gusher, and apologized for putting me through such a stressful interrogation. I bet those were just about the biggest words he knew. McAuliffe let out a humph sound at that, said something about how he'd be at the inquest to hear my statement taken, and then he left. Stalked out, actually, and slammed the door behind him hard enough to rattle the glass. Garrett gave him time to clear out, and then walked me to the door, holding my arm, but still not looking at me. He was actually sort of comical, and muttering all the time. I ain't sure what he was muttering about, but I suppose that whatever it was really Garrett's way of saying he was sorry. That man had a tender heart, and couldn't stand to see someone unhappy. I'll say that for him. And I'll say something else for Little Tall. Where else could a man like that not only be constable for almost 20 years, but get a dinner in his honor complete with a standing ovation at the end of it when he finally retired? I'll tell you what I think. A place where a tender-hearted man can succeed as an officer of the law ain't such a bad place to spend your life. Not at all. Even so, I was never gladder to hear a door close behind me than I was when Garrett's clicked shut that day. So that was the bugger, and the inquest the next day wasn't nothing compared to it. McAuliffe asked me many of the same questions, and they were hard questions, but they didn't have no power over me anymore, and we both knew it. My one tear was all very well, but McAuliffe's questions, and the fact that everyone could see he was pissed like a bear at me, went a long way toward starting the talk which has run on the island ever since. Oh, well, there would have been some talk no matter what. Ain't that right? The verdict was death by misadventure. McAuliffe didn't like it, and at the end he read his findings in a dead, level voice without ever looking up once. But what he said was official enough. Joe fell down the well while drunk, had probably called for help for quite a while without getting an answer, then tried to climb out on his own hook. He got most of the way to the top, then put his weight on the wrong stone. It pulled free, bashed him in the head hard enough to fracture his skull, not to mention his dentures, and knocked him back down to the bottom again, where he died. Maybe the biggest thing, and I never realized this until later, was they couldn't find no motive to hang on me. Of course the people in town, and Dr. McAuliffe too, I have no doubt, thought that if I had done it, I did it to get shot of him beating me. But all by itself, that didn't carry enough weight. Only Selina and Mr. Pease knew how much motive I'd really had. And no one, not even smart old Dr. McAuliffe, thought of questioning Mr. Pease. He didn't come forward on his own hook, either. If he had of, our little talk in the chatty buoy would have come out, and he'd most likely have been in trouble with the bank. I'd talked him into breaking the rules, after all. As for Selina, well, I think Selina tried me in her own court. Every now and then I'd see her eyes on me, dark as the ocean ahead of a squall line, and in my mind I'd hear her asking, "Did you do anything to him? Did you, Mama? Is it my fault? Am I the one who has to pay?" I think she did pay. That's the worst part. The little island girl who was never out of the state of Maine until she went to Boston for a swim meet when she was 18, has become a smart, successful career woman in New York City. There was an article about her in the New York Times 2 years ago. Did you know that? She writes for all those magazines and still finds time to write me once a week. But they feel like duty letters. Just like the phone calls twice a month feel like duty calls. I think the calls and the chatty little notes are the way she pays her heart to be quiet about how she don't ever come back here, about how she's cut her ties with me. Yes, I think she paid, all right. I think the one who was the most blameless of all paid the most, and that she's paying still. She's 44 years old and has never married. She's too thin, and I think she drinks. I've heard it in her voice more than once when she calls. I got an idea that might be one of the reasons she don't come home anymore. She doesn't want me to see her drinking like her father drank. Or maybe because she's afraid of what she might say if she had one too many while I was right handy. What she might ask. But never mind. It's all water over the dam now. I got away with it. That's the important thing. If there had been insurance, or if Pease hadn't have kept his mouth shut, I'm not sure I would have. Of the two, a fat insurance policy probably would have been worse. The last thing in God's round world I needed was some smart insurance investigator hooking up with that smart little Scots doctor, who was already mad as hell at the idea of being beaten by an ignorant island woman. Nope, if there had been two of them, I think they might have got me. So what happened? Why, what I imagine always happens in cases like that, when a murder's been done and not found out. Life went on, that's all. Nobody popped up with last-minute information, like in a movie. I didn't try to kill nobody else, and God didn't strike me dead with a lightning bolt. Maybe he felt hitting me with lightning over the likes of Joe St. George would have been a waste of electricity. I suppose that's blasphemy. But it also feels like nothing but the truth. Life just went on. I went back to Pinewood and to Vera. Selena took up her old friendships when she went back to school that fall, and sometimes I heard her laughing on the phone. When the news finally sunk in, little Pete took it hard. And so did Joe Jr. Joey took it harder than I'd expected, actually. He lost some weight and had some nightmares. But by the next summer, he seemed mostly all right again. The only thing that really changed during the rest of 1963 was that I had Seth Reed come over and put a cement cap on the old well. 6 months after he died, Joe's estate was settled in county probate. I wasn't even there. A week or so later, I got a paper telling me that everything was mine. I could sell it or swap it, or drop it in the deep blue sea. When I'd got done going through what he'd left, I thought the last of those choices looked like the best one. One kind of surprising thing I discovered, though, if your husband dies sudden, it can come in handy if all his friends were idiots, like Joe's were. I sold the old shortwave radio he'd been tinkering on for 10 years to Norris Panett for $25, and the three junk trucks setting in the backyard to Tommy Anderson. That fool was more'n glad to have 'em, and I used the money to buy a 59 Chevy that had wheezy valves but ran good otherwise. I also had Joe's savings passbook made over to me and reopened the kids' college accounts. Oh, and one other thing. In January of 1964, I started going by my maiden name again. I didn't make no particular fanfare about it, but I was damned if I was going to drag St. George around behind me the rest of my life like a can tied to a dog's tail. I guess you could say I cut the string holding the can. But I didn't get rid of him as easy as I got rid of his name, I can tell you that. Not that I expected to. I'm 65, and I've known for at least 50 of those years that most of what being human's about is making choices and paying the bills when they come due. Some of the choices are pretty goddamn nasty, but that don't give a person leave to just walk away from 'em, especially not if that person's got others dependent on her to do for 'em what they can't do for themselves. In a case like that, you just have to make the best choice you can and then pay the price. For me, the price was a lot of nights when I woke up in a cold sweat from bad dreams, and even more when I never got to sleep at all. That and the sound the rock made when it hit him in the face, busting his skull and his dentures. That sound, like a china plate on a brick hearth. I've heard it for 30 years. Sometimes it's what wakes me up, and sometimes it's what keeps me out of sleep, and sometimes it surprises me in broad daylight. I might be sweeping the porch at home, or polishing the silver at Vera's, or sitting down to my lunch with the TV turned to the Oprah show, and all at once I'll hear it. That sound. Or the thud when he hit bottom. Or his voice coming up out of the well. Dolores. I don't suppose those sounds I sometimes hear are so different from whatever it was that Vera really saw when she screamed about the wires in the corners or the dust bunnies under the bed. There were times, especially after she really began to fail, when I'd crawl in bed with her and hold her and think of the sound the rock made, and then close my eyes and see a china plate striking a brick hearth and shattering all to bits. When I saw that, I'd hug her like she was my sister, or like she was myself. We'd lie in that bed, each with her own fright, and finally we'd drowse off together, her with me to keep the dust bunnies away, and me with her to keep away the sound of the china plate. And sometimes, before I went to sleep, I'd think, This is how you pay off being a bitch. And it ain't no use saying if you hadn't been a bitch, you wouldn't have had to pay. Because sometimes the world makes you be a bitch. When it's all doom and dark outside, and only you inside to first make a light and then tend it, you have to be a bitch. But oh, the price. The terrible price. Andy, you suppose I could have one more tiny little nip from that bottle of yours? I'll never tell a soul. Thank you. And thank you, Nancy Bannister, for putting up with such a long-winded old broad as me. How are your fingers holding out? Are they? Good. Don't lose your courage now. I've gone at it with a shins, I know, but I guess I've finally gotten around to the part you really want to hear about just the same. That's good, because it's late and I'm tired. I've been working my whole life, but I can't remember ever being as tired as I am right now.